This is The Conversation. It's episode 162 with Ryan Wallace. He is a Brooklyn-based artist, and he is the co-owner of Halsey McKay Gallery out in East Hampton, Long Island. For those of you not familiar with the New York tri-state area, it's way out near the end of Long Island, beyond the five boroughs. And being that he is both an artist and a gallerist, of course, gave us a great opportunity to talk about the dual perspective. And we got into a nice debate about conflicts of interest. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com. Go there, find images of Ryan's work, his studio in Greenpoint, his studio out in East Hampton when he's there over the summer, and more. And, of course, you can subscribe to the show there on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever platform you like to use. Yeah, it gave us a chance to revisit what I talked about in the intro to episode 160 with writer Emily Colucci about conflicts of interest, and got pretty spirited. It also reminded me that I neglected to last time talk about tennis a little bit. And I you may have heard me mention it once before, I believe in the context of the neon yellow outfits that were going on this past U.S. Open. But what I wanted to talk about generally is that I used to watch tennis a lot, don't watch as much these days, but I was always skeptical of the in-crowdiness of that world where you have commentators, ESPN commentators pretty much, and I guess Tennis Channel as well, but you have commentators who are Davis Cup captains at the same time, who are coaches at the same time. Mary Jo Fernandez, to take one ESPN commentator in particular, her husband, Tony Godsick, is an agent who represents players like Roger Federer and others. It seems like a pretty small pool when you think of it that way. And that is all to say that sometimes the art world can feel a bit like that. But I think at the end of the day, to use one of my favorite and also most hated cliches, people ultimately don't care that much what kind of malfeasance or breach of etiquette is going on, because really it's all a case of, yeah, I've heard about that. Doesn't surprise me at all. You know, doesn't it ultimately come down to that? Where is the outrage in the art world, right? The only outrage really that seems to come up is about issues of gentrification and racism. As far as conflicts of interest and those kinds of things, you know, that's all part of the game. That's just the way it goes, right? Anyway, enough about conflicts of interest until you hear Ryan and I talk about it in a little while. I just wanted to give you the tennis analogy there. And before we get to the conversation, just want to let you know that I do have some bad advice. Might be the last one before a restart. Also wanted to give you a heads up that I will be sharing with you an open studio event out in East Orange, New Jersey, for those of you in the New York area who want to support one of the listeners who's having an open studio event out there. All right, let's get to the conversation with Ryan. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you in the back end. Where are you?
I'm in my apartment in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Right now.
Yeah, which is in Greenpoint, right?
Yeah, it is.
And which is what the neighborhood of your studio as well.
Yeah, it's like a block away, which is really nice.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. I feel like I could get more space somewhere else, but like with the kids and schedule, it's nice to be able to just run down the street and get to work and back and not have to work a commute into it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, I was in Greenpoint. I had a studio in Greenpoint many years ago, and I know it's changed a lot since then. I don't know if Greenpoint has different names, but what is your particular section like?
No, it's just Greenpoint. It's
Are you closer to the water, further from the water?
Oh, I'm like a block from the water. Yeah, so I'm like by the Greenpoint G stop.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the northern side. I'm right on Manhattan Avenue, so it's like a thoroughfare.
Right.
Not so much. I mean, it's a pretty established neighborhood, but some of the other parts of the neighborhood, I feel like have a like quainter feel.
Yeah.
But I'm like right on the in the thick of it.
Right, right. And how do you like that or not like it?
It's great. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it has its problems, but I've been here since 99.
Oh, my goodness. You're a veteran.
On a noisy street.
Yeah. So you've been there for about 17 years. So the neighborhood must have gone through a ridiculous number of changes, right?
Yeah, definitely. Though pretty slowly, it feels like. Mm-hmm. Now it seems like it's really a kind of an apex where.
Yeah.
It's hard to park because there's construction all over the place, like high-rises being built. But it was a pretty slow transition from then to now. And I feel like because it's known for being like a Polish enclave, and I feel like that has maintained where there's definitely still, like, my landlord has a Polish market below us. Some of these, like, Polish shops have dissipated over time. And the dollars, less dollars. It used to be, like, all dollar stores and kielbasa shops.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's, like, not as many dollar stores. And, like, one street over has become, like, a really kind of, not posh, but, like, there's nice restaurants. When I first moved here, there weren't really nice restaurants. Like, a few tried and didn't really work out.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's, like, there's, like, a whole scene for that.
Right. When I was talking to...
As different as it is, it seems slow.
Okay. Well, that's... See, I have to compare notes with you because I spoke with one of your neighbors, Ann Lewis, who I'm guessing you don't know, but she's an artist who lives in Greenpoint. I believe her studio is in Bushwick, if I remember right, or maybe both.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, one of the things we talked about is how... she got sort of nostalgic for the way it used to be because, you know, there had been so much change. She's somebody who's actually has dealt with gentrification in her work itself. So she's very, she's very intimate with those issues. And in fact, got kicked out of her place in Bushwick, a loft, live work loft that she had and dealt with the landlords and all that kind of stuff. So when I asked her that, she said, yeah, you know, I try not to think about it, but sometimes I do get sad, you know, because, like, that place is gone, that place is gone, that place is gone, that place is gone, you know, and so on. So compared to what you're describing, it sounds like, well, it's kind of happened so gradually that, you know, it's something that I've been able to adapt to.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. Where I also was really lucky. Now we're actually kind of maybe losing our luck, but I've been in the same apartment the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And my rent only raised twice in those 16, 17 years.
Wow.
But now that he's kind of getting ready to maybe sell the building, it's at a point where then we don't know what we'll do. Like, because we can't find anything for what we can afford. Let alone even a place like this. So I've had it pretty good, I guess, which maybe makes me pay less attention.
Right.
But
so are you keeping that potential reality outside of your blinders, so to speak, so that you don't have to think about it too
pretty
much?
I mean, well, we're kind of being forced to think about it because our rent finally went up to like a real rent. It's still like well under market, but it could potentially be a mortgage on something. And it never was that before, so we just kind of never had to think about that.
Right.
But now all that stuff is, like, at the fore right now.
Mm-hmm.
I try and not think about it, but my wife's really good about those things.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I on one hand, I kind of don't want to force you to, because I like to sort of ignore certain things. I mean, I live in a neighborhood here in Los Angeles where, since I've been here a shorter time than where you have been, you know, things have changed pretty dramatically. And if I tried to find a similar situation in this neighborhood, I couldn't do it, you know, for the same rate. So
yeah, it's totally out of the question here for us.
Right. Yeah. But on the other hand, it's just interesting from a sociological perspective that you are so representative of where so many artists are at, you know, that they're in this very fragile location.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting, too, because, like my landlord sees me as no different than, like, the people who are coming in now, which is, all, like, we get along. He loves me. But, like, to him, I'm just, like, some hipster.
Oh.
So it's also really funny to think about why, like, coming here because it didn't have all of the things that, like, it now has, which meant, one, I could afford it, and, two, that I wasn't, like, repulsed by everyone around me. But, like, still, like, artists are often lumped in with, like, gentrification.
Right. But why, having known you as long as your landlord has, why does he just lump you in with all the Johnny-come-lately hipsters?
Oh, I don't think he really does. Okay. But, like, because I'm not a Polish kid, you know?
Oh.
I didn't grow up here.
Right.
And that's, like, if you didn't grow up here, like, you're not part of the community.
Well, how many Polish kids are left at this point, do you think?
A lot.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do they own, for sure. or do you think they just have rent-stabilized situations, or both?
Both. Yeah, both. And even, like, my situation, like, he's, like, runs his market. We're not a pain. Like, he's been more than fair to us, you know? It's just not, like, how it's not looked at in the way that, like, most New York real estate landlords look at their property. Mm-hmm. Like, for him, like, having an apartment above him with the people that, like, don't make him fix everything, can handle things on their own, like, that's worth it rather than, like, more money, you know? And I think that type of attitude is kind of prevalent. Or it stays within, like, families come and go over generations, like, people come to visit, and it's like, 'cause the apartment above us, we watched, like, he and his brother would keep one room, then, like, a family came, and then, like, their relatives would come, and I think it's a lot of that, with people, like, rotating through.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, like, it serves its purpose, and it hasn't been to make money.
Remind me, though, why things might change, why he's thinking of selling?
Oh, he's just ready to retire.
Okay. And what will he do when he retires? Do you think he'll go down to Florida, or what's his story?
I don't know. He already has a place in, like, Delaware.
Okay. Got it. So he'll just be full-time retired.
Just, like, yeah.
Right.
I'd just say where I think, like, I saw, like, Williamsburg, the exodus happened a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, the money was available for those buildings, and, like, that neighborhood changed more drastically, more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I think here it really kind of kept its, not to say that gentrification isn't completely out of control here, but it still has, like, the flavor of, like, when I first moved here. I think that, like, families just didn't sell the properties at the first chance. And I don't think the money was as high as Williamsburg either, but
yeah,
no, that's probably different.
Before we get off this real estate, what is the situation with your studio? Have you also been there for many years, and it's kind of a similar deal where it hasn't gone up?
No, not really. Mm-hmm. I had, like, now it's kind of precarious. But I had a really kind of crazy situation where, also in Greenpoint, this school called St. Cecilia's, this old Catholic school, had closed down.
Mm-hmm.
And for almost 2 years, they just rented the classrooms out to artists.
Mm-hmm.
So me and an artist named Keegan McHarg had a studio that was probably, like, 1,200 square feet for, like, $200 a month.
Wow.
And then, yeah, it was, like, one of those New York stories that everyone's, like, jealous of.
Right.
And then I think he'd done something like 6 tours in Iraq as a minister, and he went back, and then the church was like, yeah, this isn't happening. And now they said that, so they eventually sold that building, and now it's $5,000 condos.
Mm.
So I had that. And
how long was that for?
Until that lasted for 2 years.
Okay, so you could save some cash for those 2 years then.
Yeah, and that actually led to a lot of kind of good things happening. be opening that gallery being one of them, but I'm sure we'll get to that. But so then I moved into the studio that I'm in now, and it's probably been, 5 years. Yeah, I've probably been in this one for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And this is a situation where, like, definitely goes up at 5% every year. I even just got, okay, so my lease is due in December, but yesterday I got a new lease raising the rent well over the 5% we agreed to, and it's 2 months early. It's like kind of like typical shitty landlord situation.
And that's again, totally legal? Like, they can raise it as much as they want?
No. Well, he's just trying to, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you
I'm
have
sure
to push back.
Down, like, but it's just, yeah, like that's the difference.
Right.
And it's under market, and it's a block away from my house, so, like, it's kind of worth it.
Yeah.
But just dealing with people like that drives me crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what one can expect in New York, especially when you're in the under market territory, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Where I feel like, I don't know. The situation we have in the apartment, I feel like it was, like, respected that, like, we came in here when we did, like, paid on time and, like, weren't a pain in the ass. Like, it's, like, worth his while, you know?
Yeah.
But this is, like, a...
What is the owner of the studio building like?
It's some like conglomerate, I
mm-hmm.
think.
That's the scariest.
He owns multiple buildings around and forgets to cash the rent check and then calls me 16 times in a row asking where it is. Stuff like that.
So it's a conglomerate, but there's a got one guy that's basically the front man for you guys, and he's fairly incompetent, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep, exactly.
You have this show up. Is it still up right now? Another few days?
Yeah, this marks the last week. Yeah, okay. Until the 15th.
Okay. So how has it been doing?
Good. Yeah, pretty good, all things considered. Pretty slow out there, so I'm happy the stuff's selling.
Right. So would it be immodest to ask you to be a little more specific, like, how many pieces are in the show? How many pieces have sold? That kind of thing.
Oh, I wouldn't want to talk about specifics, but like sales specifics. But
no, I didn't say no. I didn't say prices.
Oh, there's 7 paintings in the show, and like 2 installation elements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
Anything else?
No, that's it this time around. Usually, I include sculpture, but I wanted to kind of.
No, I mean, what I meant was, so you said, I'm glad some of the things have sold. So how many of the 7 pieces that are non-installation elements have sold, or is that 2?
I have to check with Susan. I try and leave her alone.
Right.
Probably like half or so, I think.
Okay. And what was your expectation going into the show, would you say?
Oh, I had no idea because I do run a gallery, I'm like pretty well versed in like what's going on out there, but stuff does do well, particularly stuff that hasn't been like super in under the microscope or like really hot. Like, and I kind of fall in that where I've had a pretty nice steady career trajectory and like I'm able to live off the work, but I've never been like had like a 300 person waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't have been surprised if it sold out, and I wouldn't have been surprised if it got totally goose-egged.
Totally what?
The current climate. Oh, shut, like no sales.
Oh, what was the term they used? I couldn't hear that.
Goose-egged?
Goose-egged.
Like zero?
Yeah, okay. I just couldn't make that out. Got it. Totally goose-egged, right.
But I find, and like a lot of the people that we show at the gallery too, like, if you're able to kind of stay relevant but at arm's length from like full-blown market like frenzy,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty consistent and sustainable.
Right. So that's actually...
And I feel like it was also like a big jump in the work. So I felt like that would be exciting for like the people that have followed the work for a long time.
I'm sorry. Before we got too far away from it. So the benefit of being, you know, outside of the hype zone is basically what you were saying, is that there aren't these sort of crazy potential ups and downs. It's much more steady.
Yeah, I mean, there's always ups and downs, but I feel that I've seen with some friends, when there's a real frenzy, if something happens that, like, cools it, people seem to run away a lot faster and further
mm-hmm.
than if you're not, like, really in the spotlight,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. Because what's happened recently has been kind of so specific that it just seems pretty apparent, like, that you're in a... It's a lot harder to recover from, like, falling out of favor when you're, like, someone that everybody has to have one.
Right.
Than if, like, it just kind of sells on its own accord.
Do you have anybody...
There's anything wrong with, like, any of the approaches of, like...
Mm-hmm.
Like, heist can be great. It can be used to, like, advantage, but... I don't know, we're at a point now where I think a lot of bad work was swallowed up with a lot of good work, and now since a lot of the bad stuff has, like, proven to be worth, like, close to nothing at auction, and people are expecting it, having a monetary return, kind of everything gets lumped in.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, it must all be bullshit then.
Right.
And, like, that's what I think we're seeing happen now. And, like, since, while I did well in the, like, last few years where there was, like, a big boom, I was never really a part of any of the, and that's kind of been consistent for my whole career, like, never really a part of what everybody wanted or needed to have, like, so I feel like...
Well, what about...
I don't feel at risk. Right
what
now.
About the stuff that you referred to that, when you said... There was a, you know, the good and the bad got mixed together, and then the bad sort of finally fell. What are you referring to? Can you be more specific?
There's not. I mean, like, people like to say this process-based abstraction, but I think it's not just that, really. It's more. A lot of names get thrown around, and then, like, a lot of things that looked like this get. Like, swept in. It happened, the same thing happened in the early 2000s, I feel like, where everything that kind of was associated with, like, skate culture or street culture that became really prominent in kind of, like, the Deitch wave,
mm-hmm.
I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some amazing artists in that movement, and there are a lot of things that looked just like it that got the same amount of attention and made the same amount of sales at that point in time. And now, like, we still care about Chris Johansen and Barry McGee, but we don't care about a lot of other things. And the same thing, I think, just happened where it was mostly around abstraction, but it wasn't only. And people like to focus on the abstraction, I think, because it's a good... like, narrative to focus on, but a similar thing happened where, like, there was a trend of things and some great artists and some not, and it all got lumped in together. And again, for, like, financial speculation, as much as for love or emotional response to the work.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of falls out of favor, and, like, everyone has to deal with it. It just all seems like it was really on steroids this time around, where, like, I had friends that were kind of in that early 2000s wave
mm-hmm.
that kind of rode that, and then now, like, the money then just wasn't as crazy now.
Right.
There were still, like, these what do they call them, like, art funds popped up then, and art funds were popping up again, and that's, like, it just never works. And, like, that's always a sign that, like, things are a little funky.
Is that, like, a collector's group that's sort of investing heavily in an artist? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
And it always happens when, like, but it relies on people thinking that these, like, unknown artists that they're paying $5,000 to $10,000 for are going to be worth $250,000 in 6 months. Like, and it's just not reality.
Yeah. I was looking at, there are a couple of galleries that, long running galleries here that close. One is announced that it's closing soon, called Mark Moore Gallery. And then another one that's been...
I actually am represented by Mark.
Oh, well, that's... Well, we'll have to talk about that. But before we do, just let me say that as I was looking at that information about Mark Moore, I saw a little thing on ArtNet as well about Rosamund Felsen Gallery, you know, which had its last show, I guess, go through the summer. And she was quoted as saying that these well-dressed guys would come into the gallery and they would ask for young emerging artists who would go up, you know, by, I can't remember if there was a percentage mentioned, but, you know, that would be really heavily on the rise over the next 5 years. You know, that's what they were looking for.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's
the
same conversation there, too.
Oh, it's totally the same conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that blunt, which is, like, hilarious. And there's, like, shopping lists.
Right.
But what happens is, like, when that's the only... That just muddies all of the water. Where, like, that is what it is, but its effect on the market, like, really rubs off on great collectors that just get confused by all of it.
Mm-hmm.
That I would think know better and can see the difference between, like, this painting and a Robert Ryman. But when, like, money and press is, like, being thrown at something, it's really hard to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's happened, call it the correction or whatever you want to, is the result of, like, stuff that I don't find particularly interesting, not performing as the financial tool it was expected to. And people are just like, it's all ridiculous. I'm out. There's that, and there's the other thing I've seen from, like, good collectors who I've seen that kind of buy emotionally and respond to the work, but, like, the ones that have, like, so much money it doesn't even matter are just like, nah, I guess I'll just stick with Richard Serra.
Right.
All that stuff's bullshit.
Right.
So, like, and that's, like, I've seen that happen with a few people who are not interested in young artists to make money off of them because it was never about money for them. But it's kind of soiled the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just looks like such a sham.
Yeah.
And since it was all, like, thrown into one thing. And, I mean, time will sort it out, just like it did with the last thing, you know?
Well, with this correction, though, does that diminish at all the, you know, the people with the lists? Or are they just going to be always around?
Oh, I think those ones are probably burned because... It's not, like, art costs money. You can make money on art, but, like, generally it costs money to move things, to store things, to hang things, to care for them.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start expecting a financial return beyond, like, a good artist's natural career's retail pricing,
mm-hmm.
it's probably not going to perform. Like, you can get lucky, but, like, it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. And those guys with the list really thought it was, and, like, maybe they got lucky on a handful of things, but most likely it's offset by, like, the stuff that isn't gonna work out.
Yeah.
Or even, like, good artists that do well financially, like, it gets so specific where, like, it's got to be the piece that everyone wants, like, mm-hmm. within the body of, like, it's not like if you own a, you know, without naming names, it's not like if you own any, like, artist X, that all of it is worth whatever amount of money. It's like certain ones are, and then certain ones have to be priced at a point that makes them even harder to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like those specific guys probably are out because it didn't work for them, but there will be another crop of them as soon as the market turns around. There, like, always is.
That seems like a kind of a paradox because none of these guys, and I don't know if you, from your experience, there are any women among those people with lists, collectors, but...
I'm just saying.
Sure, yeah, it's just easier to say, humans with lists.
No, it is mostly guys.
Yeah, exactly. Bros probably too, right? But the paradox, though, is that I can't imagine that any of them are putting all of their money into this kind of flipping. You know, it's probably something they're doing on the side to whatever their main gig is, right?
Yeah, sure. But, and I mean, at worst case scenario, you're just left with an art collection that hopefully you like.
But no, these guys would not. It doesn't sound like they care that much.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah, I don't know. I've never dealt with, like, getting into the nitty-gritty of, like, oh, do you trade gold also? Like, I pretty much just stick to talking about art.
Right. Well, what I was actually going to transition to, which may give you another perspective in which that you can weigh in on as a dealer, because we had only briefly talked about that before, but what's sort of describe your gallerist role, and is that past tense, or is that right? It's past tense, right?
Oh no, yeah, that's still fully going on.
Okay, what's the story?
I approach it the same as making stuff, really, where we show what we want to show and mm-hmm. kind of hope it all works out. Mm-hmm. Which I also think, that might sound a little more democratic than it really is, because we opened because we knew a peer group that we wanted to show. And that mm-hmm. has been the case, and it's grown organically, and that's kind of what motivates what we show and how it goes. But I also think that that's a good long-term business model, where now when you watch galleries take on things that you know are purely for financial reasons, like, unless the work's great, it can kind of subvert the integrity of that gallery. And I think, like, once we make it through this little lull or whatever, like, it just shows, like, oh, they sustained. And we've really found that, like, while the pacing of, like, business seems slow right now, the numbers are probably the same as they've been the last few years, like, since we've opened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same scenario where, like, we've never been, like, selling out shows and, like, had long waiting lists for anything.
Mm-hmm.
We've done really well, but, like, it trickles in, and, like,
mm-hmm.
I really think it's the result of, like, building relationships with these people and just showing work that, like, we believe in.
Right.
And that sounds, like, naive or whatever, but that's proven to kind of be the case. Just, like, just putting it out there and, like, staying on it. Like, if things don't do well, like, we try and find another outlet to show that work again at a fair or, like, something else. Like,
and where and when is this gallery?
The gallery is called Halsey McKay Gallery, and it's in East Hampton, New York.
Mm-hmm. And when did you open?
We opened in 2011. So in the tail end of, like, what was a recession.
Right.
And, yeah.
And who are who are Halsey and McKay?
It's me and my friend Hillary Schaffner, who, the name comes from our grandparents' maiden names.
I see.
Because, yeah. And also out there, Halsey has, like, kind of a connotation.
Right.
Like, the Hamptons are founded by these farmers called the Halseys, so everybody comes in and is like, oh, who's the Halsey?
Right.
And she actually is a Halsey, but, and I just didn't want my name, as an artist, I didn't want my name associated.
That's smart, yeah.
Gallery.
Right.
We didn't know if it would last, like,
yeah,
more than the 6 month lease we took on.
Right. And how does it work as far as, you know, who mans the gallery and, you know, and how often you're out there and that kind of thing?
It's like kind of tapered with the seasons, where it's a summer community, basically. So we do, like, crazy scheduling where each show is 3 weeks long for
mm-hmm.
June, July, and August.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're both out there full time pretty much then.
Mm-hmm.
Now that my kids are in school, I can't really get out there till, like, the end of June, but that's, like, full time. I mean, it's always full time, honestly. Like, when I get off the phone with you, I'm going to edit the photos for our current show and get that up in line and, like, et cetera. But
mm-hmm.
that's the, like, most physical presence. And then September through November, we're just open on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
Then January, February, usually by appointment only.
Mm-hmm.
and then back again to the spring where it's weekends only into like 3 days a week into 5 days a week.
Right, right.
It's run for anywhere from 4 to 9 weeks in the other season.
I see. I think the most important question about that project, especially based on what you were saying earlier, is, you know, you said, you described it as wanting to show a peer group and sort of having, allowing things to sort of grow organically. But the big reality is that you have to put down that lease for the first 6 months, as you said. So what is, you know, what was the overhead that you and your partner had to invest in, you know, and then were you, did you have sort of a bailout plan if, okay, if, you know, if we don't cover our expenses over the 6 months, you know, we're just going to bail, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think it was, and yeah, and I should stress that we do, neither of us, like, we need to make sales to keep the gallery afloat. Like,
sure.
I rely on it for income.
Right.
Hillary doesn't have another job, like,
right.
And we don't have, like, piles of money to, like, it's not a vanity project. Like,
right.
It needs sales to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when we opened, it was $15,000 between the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed like, that got us a 6 month lease and basically a turnkey space. I think we spent another of that 15, I think like maybe one or two of it was to build walls
mm-hmm.
that I did myself with mm-hmm. another one of the gallery artists.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed feasible that we could make in 6 months out there, it seemed feasible that we could make like $30,000 in sales, like with no expectation to make money, but like, paying for it seems plausible.
Right.
And it did.
I'm really curious about the Hamptons connection and what
right
and what your relationship to that culture was to begin with and how you have navigated that culture however
totally.
Familiar with it you were. Yeah.
So my partner grew up going out there. Her family grew up going out there.
Mm-hmm.
And my partner, business partner and my wife are like best friends. Mm-hmm. We all went to high school together.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife had been working as a chef out there in the summers.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of found myself out there.
Mm-hmm.
In high school, I kind of was like, oh, that place is lame, like whatever, the Hamptons.
Right.
But then once I found myself there more, I rented a studio, I taught myself to surf, and then it kind of seemed a lot more appealing to me.
Right.
But all the while, like, totally avoiding all of the social trappings of, like, the Hamptons that everybody kind of thinks of.
Yeah.
And just, and it is amazing. Like, there's a reason all those painters have moved out there
mm-hmm.
over time. And
right.
It's not to, like, shop at Harry Winston. Like, it's an inspiring place. Like,
mm-hmm.
all the cliches of the light and all that are totally true. So I found myself liking it there, having to be there because of my wife's work schedule. And what was also really interesting about it was because I grew up, like, snowboarding a lot and spent time in, like, the Pacific Northwest in the summers to snowboard and considered that before going to art school. And, like, I've always loved environments that aren't urban.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting about the Hamptons was most of those places, like Vermont or, like, places I spent doing, like, activities I loved, there wasn't, like, it was hard to find somebody to talk about contemporary art with.
Right.
And that's where the Hamptons is really good because it's all New Yorkers and it has a history of artists. So it's a place where, and there's art collectors, like most of the gallery's collectors are New York collectors. So it's kind of this like perfect little storm of like inspiring as an artist, but also like so wealthy and so cultured that people can support the arts. And we looked at it like historically, business-wise, it has been like mostly either, and the galleries that were out there that I loved were showing like, the younger ones were like pretty popular artists
mm-hmm.
that like I didn't know. It just didn't seem that our peer group was going to get shows there. And we thought that because, kind of naively, like now that I know how kind of most collectors' appetites work, like we were like, well, because other than that, it was a lot of secondary market stuff or a lot of like older artists. And we were like, well, if people want to like buy an Ed Ruscha, what's $4,000 to buy a Joseph Hart? And at the time, like it just kind of on paper and as a theory made sense since neither of us really knew. Though Hillary had worked in galleries, I had no idea like kind of how the apparatus worked. But like really, generally speaking, people who buy major blue chip works don't buy young emerging artists, no matter how well priced they are. But it sounded like a good idea. And it turned out to work pretty well, where we were able to kind of help build the careers of the artists that we represent, but also show other friends of ours that have gallery representation in the city. And it kind of helped almost like cut the line where like collectors that might have heard of some of the artists we were showing but didn't at the time like go to the Lower East Side. We were like right there and convenient. So we were able to kind of meet, we were able to meet people that like would have taken us a really long time as like just another gallery in New York to meet. And we like provide like good shows, and that's like really kind of just what we try and do.
I was wondering when
I
you
just hope that
when you mentioned
the
scene.
Follows.
When you mentioned the there are a few other galleries out there, but they were kind of older or secondary market. I was wondering before that, you know, how many contemporary galleries are out there, and it sounds like you fill a certain niche, right? So I guess the question
I'd say that there's more now. But yeah, that was the thinking.
And so,
and the ones that do show contemporary art, what made them so cool was that like they weren't normal white box galleries. It was like in an old garage or like a pop-up situation where you could, you know, and like that was what was exciting about out there. But we saw it as a way to try and do like a formal white box setting out there rather than like a funkier place. So like lesser known artists, but like more formal setting. If that makes sense.
And how many sales come from just sort of foot traffic, or is it a little bit more of a combination of,
Now, like very few, which is interesting. Which I think also kind of speaks to why it's able to be sustainable out there now, where 10 or 15 years ago, I don't think it would. In the beginning, I think we met some really great collectors just by like walking in and curiosity. But now it's more a situation where we have the relationships that we have from out there, but we also have like cultivated people that we've met at fairs, and like we have people in LA, in Europe, in Texas, that we're able, that like once they kind of trust what you're doing, and like once they're past the point of like buying something and getting it in their house and knowing that it's good, like it's not that people buy off JPEG, it's more that they like trust like us walking them through what the actual thing is. But, and that's what I was, this year in particular, I think like the percentage of sales that were from like people in the gallery were really low. And I think, because, and this is a point of debate, it's like, is it because of what we show that we don't sell to, like, the tourists, or is it because we're, like, 100 yards down the road from, like, the main thoroughfare? Because I would not turn away, like, some Hamptons tourist money. But it just hasn't really proven to be, like, what the core of our business is. Where a lot of people are like, oh, July and August must be, like, when you have to make all your money. And August is honestly one of the hardest times because people are so in vacation mode. That, like, they're not thinking about buying art. But, like, October has been a really good month in the past. Like, so there's really no rhyme or reason to it. The art fairs are really important.
Which and ones and how many?
Just the way that, like, we do about four a year, I'd say.
Which ones?
We've done more in the past. We've done less. This year we will do not a Miami. We'll do Dallas. We'll do a New York fair, mm-hmm. either during the Armory or during like Freeze, not a New York. And then we might do Cologne again. We did Cologne last year.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago in the past. So, yeah.
And being an artist at an art fair, what has that been like for you?
That's the only time it's weird. Because people always ask, and like generally it's like people come into the gallery, I'm just talking about art. And like you can tell if they're going to buy something or not. There's no pressure. It's just about educating them and like having a conversation and showing them something that I love.
Right.
At the art fairs, it's so about commerce. Right. That like,
how do you stomach
usually
it?
Usually Hillary's. I just know that it all helps grease the engine. Like, and 9 times out of 10, the stuff in the booth is like a close friend of ours. So, like, if I want it to happen for them, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so, the other thing that's been kind of refreshing about the whole enterprise is that it really just shows me that you can't cater your work to a market. Like, commerce and work just, like, cross on their own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's all you can do is like make your work or like put your work out there.
Yeah.
And like these art fairs help, they create a mindset that is sales oriented for the collectors, where we've had collectors from the Hamptons come into our gallery for like at least 50% of our shows and never buy anything until they see us at an art fair.
Wow.
So like, I just can't deny that, you know? And that's like what, it's going to help the business. That's what helps us do art shows. So it's just a necessary part of it.
Aren't you going to raise your prices when you show the work at the art fair?
What's that?
Aren't your prices going to be higher when you're at the art fair? And so those same people who were in the gallery and could have bought the work for $5,000 now have to pay $7,500 kind of thing?
Oh, no, the price is always the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it frustrating, though, when you see them around the gallery all the time and then finally they're at the art fair and they buy?
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can be.
I bet.
But generally, you're just happy that you're selling something. So.
Right.
Yeah,
you get
because
over it.
It's just, I don't know, the experience of, like, being in the space and seeing a show is such, for me and for all of our collectors, too, a valuable experience.
Yeah.
There's just no urgency.
Right.
And I think now people are realizing there's really no urgency at these art fairs either, but it's really good at creating that.
Right. And so when you're at your typical art fair, are you then putting on your gallerist, you know, mask, as it were, or however you want to put it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I kind of have a hands-off style, but...
Do you let your partner do most of the work?
No, but she can just stomach it a little bit better. We also have an employee who's better at it. The only time it's really soul-crushing is when I'm alone, which has only been once. I did Chicago alone,
right.
And that was really tough.
That sounds tough, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I wonder if there is a difference. Maybe it'll be quicker to say, like, yeah, I would never say, like, do you want it? Like in the gallery, you know what I mean? Like that would be like a follow-up email and like a conversation.
Right.
But in the fair setting, yeah, I think I'll be like, oh, okay, do you want it?
Like, yeah.
It's like, yeah, can be a little blunter.
Right.
Just because it's like information that you need to have, because someone might come in and want it, and then that person could be like, oh, I thought I bought that. Because it's all so wavy.
Right. That's got to be exhausting.
Or at least that's... Yeah. We've only had that happen once.
Oh, okay. But still, I mean, there's probably a lot of unspoken or unsigned activity that's just like floating around in your head all the time between fairs and the gallery and so on.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
definitely.
Right.
But it's all fun, and it's, like, fascinating. I don't know. And that actually kind of, because a lot of times people ask me about, like, how it affects my work, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so unrelated, but I am so fascinated kind of by, like, that psychology and, like, mm-hmm. what running a small business is like and what markets are like, financial markets, and how they play into this thing. But since I have, like, a hands-on outlet for that, mm-hmm. it makes working in the studio totally devoid of all of that kind of thinking,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense. Where, like, the artist you were saying that, like, makes work tied into gentrification, like, I'm really interested in that, but I'm able to keep, when I'm working in the studio, totally this, like, pure mental space that's just about art making.
Right.
It's just really kind of just about painting, as I understand it, is really where everything comes from. But
yeah,
it's nice for me, just as a person who's interested in a lot of things, to have, like, a tangible outlet to exercise one thing that doesn't have to relate to making art.
Right.
Because they really are unrelated. Like, it's so, and that's why all these economists can never figure out the art market, because it's so willy-nilly.
Mm-hmm. What about the reputational side, though? Because that's really always interested me. I have a guess about how it's going to go, but to what extent are you in situations as an artist, you know, where you are perceived a certain way because you're also a gallerist?
Yeah. I would say, yeah, it goes both ways, where I think there are some collectors that are probably never going to buy my work because they know me as a gallerist first.
Right.
Generally speaking, those tend to be financially speculative collectors who have a hard time reckoning with kind of, they really like the idea of the art star.
Right.
And that, like, you
those
can't
fuckers.
Possibly do two things well.
Yeah.
And as a result, I think I kind of try and prove that I do two things well.
Right.
But I'm totally fine with that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And even, I'm sure there are some great collectors that are just like, I don't know, it's a little weird. But on the flip side of that, because of the gallery,
mm-hmm.
my kind of, because no matter whether you like it or not, today, like, to be successful, you need some form of, like, persona.
Mm-hmm.
And you just need, like, your name has to be out there.
Right.
And as a result of the gallery, mostly from working with so many artists that I respect,
mm-hmm.
my name is out there way more than it was before the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I try and operate the gallery really ethically, and people know that I would never use it to, like, leverage my art.
Right.
So I think, just, and not to be whatever, but I've heard other people say, like, just the type of person I am,
mm-hmm.
it's not a conflict of interest. And I think that, and honestly, then I think my work stands on its own.
Yeah.
So I'm not worried about that. Like, I'm not worried about that, oh, he's getting shows because he has this gallery. Because I feel like the work stands on its own at a level that, like, you can't, again, not to sound like arrogant, but, like, you can't say the work is based on, like, a social network.
Right.
So that, like, I benefit from it, but just as much as, like, it might work against me.
Right.
I also think that the nature of those roles is a lot more fluid than it's been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Where you see artists that, like, don't have galleries, that kind of have agents work for them, or they try and do it themselves. And ironically, like, I'm still a big fan of, like, the old model gallery system, like, grow with the gallery. Like,
mm-hmm.
I think that works, mm-hmm. but I don't know.
I want to run something by you. You mentioned how ethically you run the gallery, which is good. I support that. But I mentioned something in the intro to the last episode that I put out that I want to run by you, just out of curiosity, where I became aware of a situation in which a gallerist, we'll call that gallerist spouse number one, showed uh-huh. spouse number two in that gallery. And I just wanted to know what your reaction to that is.
Oh, I think it can be totally fine.
Really?
I actually know of that happening more than you might think. I think as long, and it, again, it's kind of the same thing where if the work's good, you can't really argue with it.
Right.
I think the main danger in that situation is for the other artists on the roster to feel slighted.
Mm-hmm.
That because there's a financial gain is possible for like one family.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. if, you know, I think, and that would be the same argument if we were to like show my work, but mm-hmm. I think I'm all like in a weird way as like having felt like such an outsider in the art world for so long, like I'm like pro nepotism.
Huh.
Because like, if it's not, like, we had to make our own gallery to, like, make a scene, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so, like, if I have the ability to help out one of my friends, like, I'm going to.
Yeah.
And, like, that probably seems, from the outside, like, cliquish or, like, snobbish or, like, impenetrable. But it's because, like, I work so hard for these people that I, like, opened a business to support.
Yeah.
And I think that's lost. That was lost on me as an artist. Like, an artist in general are just kind of, like, entitled. Like, why am I not getting a show? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So in a weird way, like, if you're a good gallerist and your spouse is a good artist, like, why not? And then I just think it's on you to, like, make sure that you're serving your other artists equally.
Mm-hmm. I hear what...
As a principle, the people I find take issue with that type of thing or with like a gallery that's run by artists showing those artists are generally people that can afford to care about that, where like if you have a trust fund, like you can say whatever you want about a spouse showing a spouse, but if like they don't have money and that's their circle, then like why wouldn't they do that?
Yeah, you know, I hear what you're saying about, you know, having built up this community and wanting to help your friends. I mean, that makes sense. But in a larger, from a larger, wider angle, macroscopic angle, the perpetuating cliquishness seems like it, what it comes down to. I mean, if nepotism is just runs rampant, then are you sort of saying, implying through what you said?
So I think it's so rampant that like,
and that's okay.
You have to like champion your own thing. No, it's a total bummer, but it's a reality.
Right, but that's the thing. Like, you're perpetuating like a bummer, though, like, aren't you?
Well, I don't think with a commercially run enterprise, it's whatever, and that's like what we are. We strive to be more than that, but like it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
Business run amongst friends. Where the real problem is when it reaches institutional levels.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that those two things are the same at all.
Okay.
Like, I don't feel an honest to show, like, this, that, or whatever, just because. Where I think it is a problem when you're a collector who buys X artist, and you're on the board of this museum, and you pay for shows at that museum for this artist to increase, like, your own collection's value.
Yeah.
Like, that's a level of nepotism that I think is a totally different thing than, like, operating a commercial gallery.
Right.
On a small scale.
Right. But if a commercial...
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. But what you're saying is with a commercial gallery, to take your gallery as an example, you are building it up, you build up this community of your friends and show them and ideally sell them, and there just isn't really more room for people from outside that community to sustain the business. We don't really need more than what we already have to sustain the business, and that's where sort of the nepotism reaches its logical endpoint. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And it grows organically. Like from, let's say, the 7 people we started with,
mm-hmm.
we've been introduced to so many people. Like,
right, I see.
That it just grows on its own accord.
Yeah.
Where, like, and we're not out to, like, serve any set community in the way that, like, institutions are.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
So it just, maybe it's the nature of the artists that we work with are generous or like whatever, but like it has grown so much with like, not with little effort, but I don't feel, I never feel like, oh my God, what are the next three shows going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many things that I want to do.
Right. Right.
Which I get, which is, I guess could be, I mean, back to like the catalyst for the whole conversation is like, I guess if you're married to someone, you always are going to put that person in there. But we kind of do with the artists that we've chosen to like represent, like we show many more than that, but like we feel responsible to give them shows every few years, to bring them to art fairs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like what we promised to them. So I guess, yeah, I don't know. But I don't think it's unethical to show your spouse.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I think they're
is it like short answer?
This is, right, but this is where there are two distinct definitions that are similar but distinctly different. And one is unethical, as you say. Okay, sure, it's not maybe unethical, but it is a conflict of interest. There's no question about that.
Well, how you run it.
Depends on how you run it.
And I think that also, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would never, so, and I can only speak to like my specifics,
mm-hmm.
but I would never be like, oh, if you like Chris Duncan, you'll love Ryan Wallace. Like,
mm-hmm.
that to me would be like the conflict of interest in my position.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And like, I would just never do that. Where I think it's totally possible if you show your husband or whatever, or your wife. And I do find like there are certain, like when we're brought like a broad project, like, oh, I'm looking for like, my client has a wall that's like this size and like these are the other artists he collects. Like I usually know like, okay, these are the artists that would fit that project.
Mm-hmm.
And like if one of those artists is your husband, like it totally makes sense to put them in that list. But if it doesn't fit and then you're like, oh, but look at this too, like then that's weird.
Yeah.
But there, for me, there seems to generally be like natural answers to like broad requests that were brought,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that aren't like, oh, I'm looking for a piece by this artist, that are like, oh, we're working on a project, like who fits these things, like there are answers from our roster that I like fill or make suggestions for like those needs,
right?
That, yeah, it's just how you operate it, I guess.
Yeah, well, I have to say you're definitely at least making me reconsider, so I will definitely reweigh my my skepticism. I don't think I will change my mind. I don't think I will change my mind about it being a conflict of interest, but I may come over to your side as far as understanding that it's okay.
Well, it could be, yeah, it just could be run. And that's a like character to character assessment, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
For me, it's not so different from when we like wondered if we would show my work. And I was just like, forget it, no way.
Mm-hmm.
And Hillary was like, yeah, you're right. And our concern and my concern is that it would like subvert the like quality of both things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, if you need to show your own work, then that can infer that you can't get another gallery.
Bingo.
And vice versa.
That's Ryan. See, that's it right there. What you just said is the reason that conflict of interest is a problem. Because if spouse number two can't be shown elsewhere except at spouse number one's gallery, then how is that not, you know, a detriment to what they're trying to pull off?
Yeah, but if the work's good, then why not keep it in-house? Just to play devil's advocate.
Okay, yeah,
and
got it.
And I would say the big one is that like Canada Gallery, which I think is fantastic, is
mm-hmm.
started by artists who, mm-hmm. while they don't really show there anymore, it did at one point. And I think some are still on the roster. And I wouldn't question any of those people's ethics whatsoever.
Right.
And they all show at other galleries. Like, I just think it's more murky than it was in the past.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, that that one conflict is like, that's the main issue.
Yeah, murky, I think, is definitely a very useful word to have in the toolbox when it comes to the art world.
Yeah. Oddly enough, I've had it come up where people didn't even realize that, like, people who have, like, looked at my work mm-hmm. or even bought it didn't realize that I was the same person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's how, like, distant I keep it.
It's nice having a name that's common, isn't it? So that you can say, oh, I'm not that
Ryan
Moss.
Like, it comes up. It totally comes up. And I just, and then, like, people will come into the gallery and be like, oh, I saw your show. I loved it. And I'm not going to. Sometimes they'll be like, oh, but I'm here to talk to you about this show, like, kind of jokingly. But
right,
like,
right.
It comes up, but I, like, the weirdest time I feel is, like, I was speaking at my current show at Susan's, and, like, someone introduced me. Someone was leading a tour who knows me also through Halsey, and mm-hmm. was like, oh, this is Ryan's show, and he also runs a Geary gallery in Long Island. And I was like,
oh, don't say that.
Because then it felt like, yeah. Because I don't care, but then it felt like I was in Susan's space. Like, Susan wants to sell my show. Like,
right.
It was like an advertisement for another gallery.
Yeah.
And it was totally fine and friendly, but, like, that felt weird. But generally, like, I just try and stay away from cross-pollinating directly, and, like,
yeah,
it runs itself.
Sure. Well, we should get back to, before we run out of time, Mark Moore Gallery, since we put that we put that on hold. So you've been represented by them, and now they're about to close. So what did you get a personal alert, or did you find out via mass email, or what?
Both, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
I heard from another person, but then I got the email.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what was your thought?
It's crazy. My thoughts are, I mean, it's kind of, because a lot of galleries are closing, you know. It was tough because he has been in business for so long.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mostly just felt for him that, like, I know that was not an easy decision for him.
Mm-hmm,
I felt fortunate in that, like, it happened at a time when I have a show up in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple other galleries that I work with. So, like, I feel really lucky that,
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
that it's not, like, my only support network.
Right.
So that is, like, fortunate for me. But he's great to work with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he will. He'll still do stuff. Like, I don't think that's it. But,
well, he's doing secondary market stuff.
Since
after he closes, right? And consulting.
Well, I think he'll keep trying to push
his artists,
too.
Mm-hmm.
I think I still owe him a phone call to kind of touch base on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think secondary market being handed over to the auction houses so heavily is a big part of why a lot of galleries are closing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Mark had a great secondary market business.
Right.
So that, I don't know, it was just, like, because so many galleries are closing, and as someone who runs a gallery, we're always like, oh, should we try and open in New York? Should we move to New York? But all these galleries that are comparable are closing. Like, what does that mean? Like, but they're mostly galleries like us. And to see someone who's been in business for 33 years close is, like, a little harder.
Yeah.
You know?
When you say all these galleries are closing, are you talking about a rush, a departure that is unlike anything over the last 10 years, or is this just another wave that you're referring to?
I think it feels like another wave.
Right.
I wasn't as tuned into the art world as I am now
mm-hmm.
10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
but I remember when, like, Clementine closed and ATM closed and Oliver Cam closed and Daniel Wright closed. Like, that felt
right.
Like the wave of galleries that have closed in New York now.
Mm-hmm.
But
here, you know, Mark Moore closed and Rosamund Felsen closed and a couple of other galleries closed, but then a ton of galleries have been opening, you know, over the last year as well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Right. So is that happening in New York too?
Mm,
not so much.
I'd say not really. I think there's a big there's a big New York to LA expansion that happens every so years. That's definitely going on now.
Right.
And I think generally the mood in New York is like tentative.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, but there are totally young galleries opening.
Yeah.
Very modestly, you know?
Yeah.
Like, which is good and healthy. And like, that's how exciting new art gets shown.
And have you as a gallery...
That's the other kind of...
I was just going to say, as a gallery, since you opened 5 years ago, roughly, are you now in sort of the middle level gallery section of the art fairs, you know, where as opposed to the emerging section?
Oh, no. No way.
Okay, you're still in the emerging section.
Like, a middle level gallery to me is, like, so wildly successful. Like,
oh, really? Uh-huh.
No, we're still, like, a young right. gallery, for
right.
sure,
right.
in the emerging sections of fairs.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, by today's standards, like, someone like Mark is a mid-tier gallery, you know?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Yeah.
And we're, yeah.
For some reason, I've got to go back to the Hamptons, because when you were talking about it and I was picturing it, I couldn't get out of my mind this article that ran, I think, sometime maybe a year ago, last summer, even more recently, that was about Montauk and kind of the total explosion out there, you know, and the sort of...
Yeah, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, so is that just Montauk, or has East Hampton had any of that as well?
I'd say it's just Montauk in that, and that's a place where everything here has maybe seemed slow. That has not seemed slow.
Right.
The Hamptons were always, like, too hoity-toity for that sort of scene. And Montauk was really, like, a fishing town. And, like,
right.
a working class vacation spot.
Right.
And it really was that, and that's, like, how it stayed. And the big difference, like, the Hamptons, and Montauk is part of the Hamptons, but
yeah.
the Hamptons are known for being pretentious and showy and, like, things that, like, people associate with the Hamptons, but Montauk was not that.
Right.
And so when a certain... And the other big difference is that people went out there and, like, it's one thing if you're, like, not from a culture or a community and, like, you go somewhere. But it's another thing when you go somewhere and you just, like, piss all over the place and you don't try and integrate and you, like,
mm-hmm.
walk all over things.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that really, it's been behavior, like.
It's been what behavior?
It just wasn't the case out there.
You cut
it's
off
terrible,
again.
Like, vacation or vacation behavior.
Right,
like,
right, right. Yeah.
Where people just don't respect, like, anything. And so that has been really resisted by, like, a kind of a tough community, you know?
Yeah.
So where it just couldn't happen in the like, in, like, East or Southampton in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Because it's already
the,
built
like,
out.
The setting is so different.
Because it's so built out, Southampton and East Hampton are already kind of maxed out in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just wouldn't attract kind of the same type of revelry, I guess.
Right.
And also it's kind of set up in a way where, because it really is like, it's like class problems where
mm-hmm.
people feel entitled to act that way there, where the setup in the other parts of the Hamptons isn't that,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
There's tons of entitlement, but you can't interlope in to be more entitled.
Right. When you've been out there this past summer or any time, have you gone up there to just check out the scene?
Oh yeah. I go surfing there all the time.
Right. So have you been there at night at any of those clubs that are getting
no.
a lot of attention? That's when you get
no,
out of there, right?
I mean, I've been to the Surf Lodge for, like, events and stuff, but, like, I don't go out to clubs, so, like, I haven't, you know.
Yeah.
But I've just seen, like, around town, like, when you go to get, like, a sandwich and there's, like, no fedora hat signs. Like, it's pretty apparent that there's something going on.
Mm-hmm. Right. Huh. Well, do you think we've covered
yeah.
the waterfront, Ryan?
Do I think what?
Do you think we've covered the waterfront?
I think we've covered the waterfront, yeah.
Good, good. It's my sign-off, and it seems particularly relevant, being that we were just talking about the Hamptons, so.
No, definitely. And gentrification. And it's the same thing that's happening in Montauk. It's like people from Williamsburg going out there.
Yeah. Boy, that's like the...
So it's like all...
It's the douche train, right?
Yeah.
Got
and
it.
It's like, yeah, it's funny.
Well, I hope...
Yeah, it's crazy.
I hope that... I can't not say that I hope that you get to stick around Greenpoint for a while yet.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I know, me too.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking to me. It was fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
You bet. And... we're out. Thanks again to Ryan Wallace for talking to me, and thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Wanted to remind you before we get to some bad advice and a open studio scenario in East Orange, New Jersey, that this is a listener-supported show. It would be very much appreciated if you would like to support the show financially if you go to theconversationpod.com/support and provide a nice donation. It would be very much appreciated. I love getting the emails in the conversations, specially marked section of the inbox saying you have received a donation. So thank you in advance for doing so. Of course, you can also support the show by leaving a nice review on iTunes. Helps more people find the show. That iTunes page is linked through the website. You can also look up on iTunes The Conversation, an artist podcast. If you are not a follower on Instagram, please do so at Artist Podcast or Twitter, same, Facebook. And it's very much appreciated if you take a shot of your studio or wherever you are listening to this show and put it up on Instagram with at Artist Podcast in the caption. That would be awesome as well. All right, so let's get to some bad advice, but first, I wanted to give you a heads up about one of our listeners. Catherine Mitchell is involved in an open studio out in East Orange, New Jersey. It is an easy train ride from New York City, and the location is Manufacturers Village, and that's at 356 Glenwood Avenue, East Orange, New Jersey. And that is on Sunday, November 6th. From 1 to 5 p.m. So go check that out. Be a supporter of one of our listeners if you are nearby. It's going to be a big village of artists. It looks pretty interesting from the photo that I've seen. So go check that out. All right, now let's get to some bad advice for the week, courtesy of Xander Lassen. People need art in their houses. They don't need Bed Bath & Beyond dentist office art. They need weird stuff. Ezra Croft, I don't know who that is, but that's who said it. The better you do, the more you hear from people who hate you. So you have to give yourself permission to do things that a lot of people hate. James Al Tucker and the Ringer for the week. That's the problem with bad reviews. They're usually right. John Curran. All right, ladies and gents, thank you very much for being here, for listening to the show. Your comments, thoughts, maybe even complaints are welcome through theconversationpod.com, or you can just email me directly, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com, and follow us on one of those social media handles if you would, donate, etc. Thank you again for listening. I will talk to you again next week. Ciao for now.